This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, there are lots and lots of books and workshops and tools and apps out there that try to help us make the best use of our time, promoting time management and productivity hacks. The author of a new book takes a different approach. Instead of focusing on being more efficient and getting more done, he wants us to accept that we'll never get it all done. Time is limited. You'll never have time for everything. And that's good news if we know what to do with it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you tried using time management advice from a book or an app or whatnot? Did anything work for you? Or did you feel as busy as you did before or even busier? How do you make time for the things that are important to you in your life, whatever those may be? How do you decide what's important for you to spend your time on? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Oliver Berkman is a journalist and author. He wrote a long-running weekly column on psychology called This Column Will Change Your Life for The Guardian. His new book is called 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. Oliver, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks very much. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, 4,000 weeks. When I found out what that meant, it's a little disturbing in a way. What's up with 4,000 weeks, Oliver?
4,000 weeks is very approximately the number of weeks you're going to get if you live to be around 80. I definitely rounded the number for effect. But I think that what's really important about that number is not really the exact figure. It's just that any life, even the sort of record-breaking, very long-lived people who sort of live until they're like 120, it's all so finite. When you think about it in weeks, it's 4,000, maybe 5,000 if you're lucky. It's not a lot.
You have tried lots of other time management advice over the years and productivity tips and things like that. What is the focus of a lot of the stuff out there that you see steering us in the wrong direction?
I mean, there's good stuff as well as bad stuff, but what there is and what I was for a long time is this phenomenon of people using this advice to try really to feel completely in control of time, to feel like they have their lives in working order, to feel like there is nothing that could be thrown at them that they would be unable to deal with, no ambition they could have that they couldn't put into practice. You know, it's this kind of omnipotence that I think we are seeking and that a lot of productivity gurus are encouraging us to try to achieve. And my argument is, you know, number one, it's not possible for a finite human to be omnipotent with respect to time. Number two, it's not even a worthwhile thing to try to do, because what it does is it actually undermines your ability to have time and focus for the things that matter the most to you in life.
Yeah, this idea that if I'm just efficient in how I use my time, I'm going to get to do all the stuff that I want to do, that other people want me to do. I'll keep up with my work. My house is going to be clean. I'm going to make great meals. Like, right, you can't do it, can you?
No, right. We live in, especially today, I think it's always been true in some sense, but especially today, because of technology, the economy, a lot of other things, we live in a world of what I call infinite inputs, right? There's always another email that you could be sent. There's always another demand your boss could make. Likewise, you know, there's always another exotic location you could have on your bucket list. It's not all unpleasant things, but it is all these kind of limitless inputs. And trying to get more efficient at getting through some limitless inputs is like, you know, getting faster at climbing up an infinitely tall ladder. You feel more rushed, but you're never going to get to the top of it because it's infinite.
So the core of your book, it seems to be, it's a mindset change. What is the mindset you're hoping to shake us into here?
The mindset I'm hoping to shake us into, which you know, absolutely is one that I have had to struggle with myself and still to some extent do struggle with, is to just see the facts, to just understand that getting on top of everything, doing everything, it's completely off the table to begin with. It's not that you failed to find the right time management technique or that you weren't self-disciplined enough. It's like trying to make 2 + 2 add up to 5, right? It's not going to happen. Once you see that, and once you can deal with the discomfort that arises from that, because it is an uncomfortable realization, at that point, you can instead choose to put your time and your attention onto a handful of things that matter the most. You have to give up this feeling that next month or next year, that's when you're going to be fully optimized, totally efficient, totally in control. Because of course, anyone like me who's struggled to try to achieve this feeling, like it's always off in the future. It's never now. It's always like you're just being led towards like maybe it's soon, but it actually never happens. And I think giving up hope in that respect, admitting defeat in a certain way, is actually the first step to being way more effective when it comes to using your time on things that you really care about.
Talking to Oliver Berkman about his new book, 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have trouble deciding how to best spend your time? Do you feel overwhelmed trying to do it all? Have you had a realization that you can't do it all? How do you prioritize what is important in your life to spend your time on? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Oliver, I'm going to describe a feeling I often have, and I'm guessing from your book, a lot of people have it. I'm doing a thing, watching a movie, playing a computer game, hanging out, whatever. At the back of my mind is the fact that the thing I'm doing means I'm not doing all the other cool things I could be doing or important things I could be doing in the world. How do I shake that? How do we shake that?
Well, again, I'm not sure you should shake it. I think you should kind of almost go deeper into it and see, like, that feeling is reflecting the fact that every time we decide to do anything with an hour, with a week, with a lifetime, we are, by definition, right, neglecting a million other things. It's just the way it works to be a finite human. And I actually think that's one of those feelings that it's most tormenting when you sort of feel it a little bit. It's less tormenting when you really stare it in the face, because then you see, sure, you know, I'm always going to be missing out on stuff. Never mind the fear of missing out that, you know, is supposed to sort of ruin our lives these days. It's the inevitability of missing out. And I think once you accept that, you can sort of stop beating yourself up for the fact that you're choosing one thing over another thing. And that's when you can make better choices and you can ask, like, okay, is the thing I'm doing right now with my time the most meaningful thing for me in my circumstance in life to be doing it? So it's kind of really liberating to give up this hope that one day you're going to somehow be able to not miss out on things.
How do we do that kind of arranging, figuring out the things that are important to us or that are going to make us happy or fulfilled or whatever good thing we're looking for? How do we sort that out and then put it at the top of that list for some of our buckets of time?
It's a really good question. I mean, in the book, I do get into some really sort of down-to-earth little tips and techniques, but I think that the most important point is this kind of, it's this mindset shift that we're talking about. It's this willingness to tolerate some discomfort. And I think it is just this recognition that a lot of the things that matter to us the most don't always feel really comfortable. They don't always feel really good. If you're working on a difficult piece of creative work, or you are looking after a child who you love deeply, something like that, you're going to encounter like resistance, boredom, the feeling that it's too difficult and you want to do something that feels more pleasant, like, you know, just scroll through your phone on social media or something. And that's fine, because all you're feeling there is the fact that I think the things that matter to us do bring us up against our edges and our limitations. They do challenge us because the stakes are higher. And I think just sort of expecting it to feel that way makes a huge difference, because soon it then, you know, I don't think the discomfort always lasts. I think you can get into sort of deep absorption and fulfillment from doing these activities, but just not expecting any of this to be like super comfortable right from the start, I think makes a massive difference.
We're talking to Oliver Berkman, journalist and author, about his new book. It's called 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. He says, instead of trying to get so efficient that we can do it all the things we want and have to do in our lives, we are probably better off realizing that we're finite. We don't have that much time. We can't do it all. And that's going to help us realize what's important, what we want to spend our time doing when we have the choice. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does any of this ring a bell with you? Did you realize that, hey, maybe there are some things I'm spending a lot of time on that don't bring me happiness or joy or fulfillment, and I can stop them or maybe spend less time on them. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your experiences, maybe your questions for our guest. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
The eighth season of Wisconsin Life on PBS Wisconsin offers plenty to get excited about. Host Angela Fitzgerald connects viewers with people whose passions, experiences, and expertise celebrate the best of Wisconsin. New episodes air 7 p.m. Thursdays on PBS Wisconsin. Episodes are also available to stream at pbswisconsin.org and on the free PBS video app, on streaming devices and smart TVs.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk now with author Oliver Berkman. His new book is called 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. He says, no matter how much time management and productivity training we get, we can't do all the stuff we want to do in life or feel like we should do in life, and that's okay. And knowing that is actually going to help us pick and choose and use our time in good ways. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you tried time management advice in a book or an app or whatever? How did it work for you? Have you realized there are things you can leave out? You don't have to get through every email, say, in your inbox. Your yard doesn't have to look perfect, so you can use that time on better stuff. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller now. Destiny is with us in Milwaukee. Destiny, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
I really appreciate the guest speaker talking about how you just sometimes may be uncomfortable with these realizations. And something that really helped me was to stop using the word should, especially as a new mom. I constantly am telling myself, like, you should be doing the laundry, or you should be helping with the yard work, or whatever that may be. And realizing that if I just changed the word should to could, I was much more comfortable with what I was actually choosing to spend my time on. So I could be doing the laundry, or I could be making a phone call to a really good friend, and just feeling still fulfilled with what I was doing.
Destiny, I'm glad you could make a call to us. Thank you so much for sharing that. Oliver, what do you think of what Destiny had to say?
I think that's just a fantastic point. I think that, you know, the word should is so interesting because you can generate a list of 100 things that you feel you should be doing. There's no reason to believe that that is going to be, that you're going to have enough time for all those things, right? I mean, maybe you've got time for 5 of them. But so our minds are capable of this kind of limitless level of, you know, beating ourselves up for all the things we're supposed to be doing. And it just sort of floats free of the basic math, which is like, there are so many hours in the day and you're going to have to sleep for some of them. And you should try to give a little bit of time to resting and to doing things for yourself. So I think it's a great, great point. And of course, there are things that we feel duty bound to do, but it really makes no sense to think that we're duty bound to do more things than it's humanly possible to do. That's just a non-starter.
Destiny, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Oliver, reading your book, what I thought about a lot is my experience with vacations. Once upon a time, if I'd paid the money to go somewhere and taken the time to get somewhere and knowing I probably would never get back, I'd have the mindset that I have to see every single thing there is to see and eat all the foods and, you know, all the stuff. And then I said, you know what? No, I'm going to just enjoy bits and pieces and know I'm going to miss stuff. And I enjoy traveling a whole lot more when I get the opportunity to do it. That I don't know. That's what I thought about reading your book. That mindset I should maybe take from my travel to the rest of my life.
I think it's, yes, I absolutely. I mean, I think what's going on there is this way that we almost turn leisure into another kind of work.
Yeah.
And what we're doing there in work as well as in leisure is really focusing on the instrumental benefits of time, right? We're thinking about time entirely as something that we're using for some future purpose. And in the case of vacations, it's the future purpose of that lovely satisfied feeling that you really got the most out of your vacation. But if you completely fixate on using time for future benefit, you're kind of not present to the time itself, and the present and the future kind of never arrives, so you miss your life. I think it's a really good point. I think it's actually worth thinking about vacations and days off as an opportunity to waste time. Like, almost, I think we need that in our culture these days. We're so wired to try to use all our leisure time well. It's almost a challenge to try to almost deliberately do something that has no benefit for our careers or for the future or for our families, et cetera, et cetera.
Talking to Oliver Berkman about his new book. It's called 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. Still time for you to share your thoughts, your experiences, or maybe your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. If you'd like, that's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Oliver, you've mentioned here and you write about this. You're working toward this mindset shift. You're encouraging it for others, but it isn't always easy, even for you, having worked on this for some years now. What are some of the roadblocks you've encountered?
I mean, I just think that I have, and I think a lot of people have, a pretty deep-seated notion that we need to do a huge amount of stuff. We need to be incredibly productive, not just to pay the rent and to make our lives sort of work out financially, which we do, I accept that, but to feel like we've justified our existence on the planet. You know, there's a whole self-worth piece built into this where you kind of think that it would be somehow immoral if you spent the whole day in the park reading a novel. Now, you might not be able to spend the whole day in the park reading the novel because of your financial situation or your employment situation. But if you get those little chances, even for a half an hour here or there, like, I think the big challenge is, like, don't make it into a thing where you're like, you feel like you're not justified in existing unless you are producing stuff. So that for me has been a big challenge. This notion that, like, you're enough regardless of what you produce, and then sure, go ahead and produce some things and accomplish some things because that's good to do, but not as the condition of your, not as your sort of price of admission for being human, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. And you write about, and this is getting more toward the practical side of things, I think there are a lot of things we can do that might feel productive, but there may be distractions from the good stuff, or whatever the good stuff might be. How do we tell one from the other?
Well, we live, don't we, in this culture that sort of really, really champions doing things, kind of almost regardless of what the things are. If you get to the end of a work day and you, like, did a lot of stuff, you're liable to feel very virtuous, like you did your part. But there's no virtue inherently in just doing things. It depends what things. So yeah, I think there are a lot of techniques and approaches to this. A very simple one is that if you have the control over your work day, not everyone does, but if you have, to really try to spend the first 2 or 3 hours on something that really counts and that really matters, and to just not touch the inbox or the little bits of admin until after you've put in those 2 or 3 hours. To resist this urge to say, well, okay, I just got into work, I'm going to clear the decks, get everything a little out of the way so that I can focus. Because of course what happens is you never clear the decks. In fact, the act of trying to clear the decks just generates more stuff on the decks. So, you know, putting what matters the most first for a sort of ring fence 2 or 3 hours in the day is an incredibly powerful practice, I think.
I want to get a little more into something you've mentioned a couple times now, the idea that at some point in the future, I'm going to have the time to do the stuff when, or the resources, when I have the good job, or when I retire, or when the kids move out, or whatever. What advice do you have for us to take that future and start working it into our daily life now?
Well, I love this insight that comes from a creativity coach called Jessica Abel, who says that, you know, this idea from personal finance about paying yourself first, in other words, putting a bit of money into savings as soon as you receive a paycheck instead of hoping that it'll be left over when you've spent all your, you know, paid all your bills and bought your groceries and everything. The same applies to time. If you think that, you know, writing a novel, writing songs, or nurturing a specific relationship in your life, whatever it is the thing that you really plan to do when you get the time, the only way is to do a little bit of it right now, you know, to do a little bit of it today, even if it's half an hour, even if it's 20 minutes, even if you don't feel ready or qualified yet to do that thing. Pay yourself first with time. Do a little bit of that right now and keep doing that as many days as you can. And just accept that, yeah, you're going to feel like, no, I wanted to wait a few years until I was in the right frame of mind. But just understand that that's a trap.
Leslie in Cottage Grove emailed us. Leslie says, once you're retired, you have a great sense of time's limits and it becomes easier to choose to spend time on things that personally matter. I can work on whatever I want to. Well, I want to spend our just the last half a minute, Oliver, remind us the realization that we can realize those limits of time right now and start working with it.
Right. I mean, I really take that point. I think it's excellent about retirement, and I think it really does liberate a lot of people. The difference between someone in retirement and someone earlier on in life, like we're all on this, it's not that huge. We're all in this very short little span of time, and we could all do to, I think, spend a bit more time on what we care about the most and a bit less time convincing ourselves that we one day might be able to do everything.
Well, Oliver, thanks for using some of your time with us today. I appreciate it.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Oliver Berkman is a journalist and author. We've been talking about his latest book. It's called 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. You can still share your thoughts, maybe your own advice. Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Coming up after the news, the author of the new book, We're Not Broken, shares stories of life with autism and says we need to change the conversation from fixes and cures to mutual understanding. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, there's a lot of misinformation out there about autism, from myths about vaccines to misconceptions about who's affected by autism. Our next guest is a reporter who's on the autism spectrum himself. In his new book, he shares stories from people around the country and tackles some of those myths and misconceptions. And he says, we need to rethink the autism conversation and move from talking about cures and treatments to finding better ways to include people at work, at school, and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Are you autistic? Or is someone in your family, one of your loved ones, autistic? What do you think people get wrong about it? What are ways that society is not built for people with autism? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Eric Michael Garcia is a senior D.C. correspondent for The Independent. He's the author of the new book, We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. Eric, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Can you talk a little bit about what led you as a reporter, a journalist with autism to tackle this book and talk to people around the country to share their stories?
Sure. So first off, I was born. I was born autistic. That's an old joke for you. The second thing that happened was that I moved to Washington, D.C. when I was 23. I moved to be an economics and politics journalist. I always wanted to be that. Didn't think I'd ever be anything more than that. Then I was at a party one night with a friend by the name of Tim Mack. And he offered me a drink. And I said, oh, I don't drink because I'm on the autism spectrum. And a medicine I take doesn't mix with alcohol. And he's like, oh, there's a lot of autistic people in Washington, D.C., in politics, in law, in journalism, and things like that. He's like, you should write something about that. And I thought, okay, you know, maybe one day. But then when I was at National Journal and then they were shutting down the print magazine, I pitched that article to my editor. And he's like, well, why should this exist? And he's like, well, I said, well, I think we focus too much on trying to cure autistic people, not enough on trying to help them live fulfilling lives. He's like, there's your piece right there. And then, so I wrote that piece. That broke big. And then my next question was, well, what would that look like? And you have to remember around this time in 2015, I grew up in Southern California. There was a big measles outbreak at Disneyland, if you remember. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, and like those people, I mean, those are a bunch of hippies in California. And at the same time, Donald Trump was running for president and he was saying that autism has become an epidemic. He blamed vaccines. Just saying a lot of things that were just not true. So my feeling was somewhere along the line, we've gotten a lot wrong about autism. And as a political journalist, my feeling is, okay, if we're getting things wrong about autism, that must mean that what we do to help, quote unquote, help autistic people must be really bad too. So I hit the road and I, you know, I'm a political journalist at heart. So I decided to hit the road and see how are we failing autistic people? But more importantly, what could be done to make things better for autistic people?
And a recurring theme in your book, I mean, it's in the title, you just mentioned it, it's all throughout the book, this idea that we're not broken, you're not broken, and moving the conversation from how do we prevent autism, cure autism, fix autism, whatever, to how do we change society so that we include people with different neurodiversity, I think is the phrase often used.
Different neurodivergent, you know. So the stat I always give is that of the $364 million the United States spends, both with nonprofits and with the federal government, spends on autism research, and this is from 2016, only about 2% of that goes toward lifespan issues. By comparison, about 35% of autism spending research goes on biology, and about 24% goes on risk factors. So that's about half of our research budget goes to what causes autism, and then, you know, what are risk factors. And then on top of that, there are treatments. So that's a large part of it. And then we're not really spending that much on what happens to autistic people as they grow up. What are the difficulties that they face? What are the difficulties as they want to go to school, or if they don't want, if they can't go to school, or if they can work, or if they can't work? What's the problems facing unemployment? So to me, that seemed like a big problem, because it seemed like for a long time we were focusing on what parents or what researchers or what clinicians or professors wanted, and less on what can we actually do for the people right here and right now. You know, even if you were to create a cure, that's not going to help autistic people who you have right now.
One other misconception you look at is who people think of as autistic. And I think the image that I'll admit usually would pop into my mind, and I think for a lot of people, is they're young, they're white, and they're male. And that is not accurate at all, right?
Right. I mean, like the classic example is if you look at shows like The Good Doctor, or what's the other one? Atypical, or even going back to shows like or movies like Rain Man, the archetype of an autistic person is typically a young, typically adolescent or teenage white male, sometimes older. And if you look at covers like Time and Newsweek, I went back and I looked at a lot of covers of Time magazine, and it was like young, you know, blonde haired adolescent boys. But like A, that excludes a lot of adults. B, that excludes a lot of women and girls. And C, that really excludes a lot of people of color. And it goes back to my point that in the original study about autism in 1943, the first widely read study about autism in 1943, Autistic Disturbances of Affective Contact by Leo Kanner, none of the children were people of color. Only 3 of them were girls. 9 of them were from Anglo-Saxon families, and the other 2 were Jewish. And as a result, we kind of still have that idea of those are the type of people who can be autistic.
We're talking to Eric Michael Garcia about his new book, We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. You can join in with your thoughts, your experiences, maybe your questions at 800-642-1234. A quote, Eric, that struck me in your book is from John Elder Robison, an autistic author and advocate. I'm quoting him now, as you quoted in your book. Our duty in autism is not to cure, but to relieve suffering and to maximize each person's potential. Can you talk about that mindset as a starting point?
Certainly. I think that when a lot of people say that we talk about not curing autism, we're saying that autism is all rainbows and butterflies, or it's not a disability. Autism is a disability. I will say that from the rooftops. But what we should do is we should work to fix the impairments, or work to help autistic people with their impairments. And then we should also work to maximize their potential. And just like how deaf people don't want to be cured, or blind people don't want to be cured, we wouldn't want to cure people with Down syndrome. We should work to improve the lives of autistic people, get rid of the impairments, but then also find ways to make the world more adaptable to them, and find ways to make the world better for them. So a statistic that I cite, and we don't even really know, is that autistic people, around 85% of autistic young adults we know, deal with unemployment. That's a big social problem. We should look at what does it take to help autistic people find work and make sure that they have good jobs if they want to work, or if they can work. What does it take, and how can we facilitate that more than just, oh, we should try to fix them, you know?
You give an example from your own career, your academic career at community college, then at the University of North Carolina, about accommodations for you that you were initially reluctant to ask about.
So, I mean, I think that a lot of autistic people and a lot of disabled people as a whole, especially when you go to university, you've already gone through a special education system at one point or another, and you've seen how often it usually doesn't help, or it's segregating and it's isolating, or you get treated, or you know, because kids can be so cruel, they see that it puts a mark on your back, or there's a lot of other things. So a lot of times we just don't want to talk about it. And then also we're afraid that we're going to be seen as getting special treatment. It's why I'm not a fan of the term special needs. But those accommodations are there, and they're there for a reason, and they matter. And I think that a lot of times we have to overcome our ableism, our internalized ableism, and the thoughts that, you know, we're told from the beginning of our lives that we're a problem. And we need to recognize that those services are there for a reason. And I think on top of that, we're also kind of told that, well, if you're at university, you must not be really disabled, right? Which is like such a terrible thing to say, because it says that only certain types of people can go to university. It says that you can't go to university if you're disabled. What we should do is we should say that, you know, you're here for a reason. These accommodations are here to help you, and we should not fear them, you know.
We're talking to Eric Michael Garcia, senior DC correspondent for The Independent. He's talking to us about his new book. It's called We're Not Broken: Changing the Autism Conversation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have experience with autism yourself? If you're willing to share the story of when you first found out about a diagnosis, maybe it's somebody in your family. Or do you have a question for our guest about the conversations he had with people around the country, the different accommodations he found out about along the way? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
Wisconsin Public Radio stays connected with the whole state thanks to its network of 7 bureaus. With reporters on the ground across Wisconsin, WPR provides a news service that connects with issues that matter to your life. Stay in touch with WPR.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Join us for Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Certain parts of his brain light up when he does that.
Beta is a polyphonic mosh pit where high culture and low culture collide.
Coming out of the gate.
We take an immersive, innovative, playful, and provocative approach to exploring arts, culture, and technology. Saturday morning at 11 on the Ideas Network.
The 2011 political district map changed the game for Wisconsin.
You know, it was pretty much of a Democratic landsliding. You know, we got wiped out. And then somebody said to me, well, don't worry, we're still in control of the assembly. I said, how can that be?
Listen to WPR Reports Mapped Out and find out why maps matter so much. It's at WPR.org/mappedout or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Eric Michael Garcia about his new book, We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. You can join in 800-642-1234 with your experiences, maybe with autism yourself or with a loved one, or your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Eric, as part of your work on this book, you talked to people who need more care in their everyday lives, who, for example, yes, maybe university may not be an option, who had experiences different than your own. What kind of things did you learn from them?
Yeah, they were, it was really important for me to include autistic people who have higher support needs or maybe who can't speak. And it was important for me to say that because or maybe university might not be an option for them. And it was important for me because I wanted to show that they could have a good life and that it's possible to have a good life. Because I think a lot of times people say, and I knew the response to this book would be, oh, it's easy for you to say because you are quote unquote high functioning, even though I'm not a fan of that term. And you are successful, you have a job, things like that. But what about my kid? So I wanted to include people who are, A, I believe that I have a lot more in common with your kid than you realized. B, I wanted to include people like these kids, and like your child. And I wanted to show that it was possible to live a good and happy life. And the way we do that is by having a support system around you, a support system around these people, and B, that we... that it requires spending and it requires prioritization of these things. And it requires that we prioritize ensuring that these people have home and community-based services that they so that they can live in the community, that these are actual home and community-based services, that they're not just de facto institutions like they often have been. Or we wanted to, you know, I wanted to show that it's possible for them that they should have, you know, home care workers who care about them and take them seriously and take their medical needs seriously. I wanted to make sure that if they have intellectual disabilities, they aren't exploited in workshops, segregated workshops, or paid below the minimum wage, which is completely legal and people don't realize that. So it was really important for me to include their voices as well.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Kathy is with us in Winona, Minnesota. Kathy, hi.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking this call. My question is regarding, first of all, Eric, you're a brilliant guy, and kudos to you for doing what you do.
Thank you.
I have met a young man who's 24 years old. He's very affected by autism. He is not able to live by himself. He goes to a day program, but he says to me, I am not autistic, I have autism. And I'm wondering, I hear you referring to autistic people, and I'm wondering which you prefer.
Kathy, thanks for the call.
So,
yeah, go ahead, Eric.
That is a good question. That is a really good question. The thing that I did when I was traveling around, I made sure to ask, was I was really keen to ask people, do you prefer to use what's called person first language or identity first language? Person first language is, I believe, what this gentleman is referring to himself as. I have autism, and then I tend to say that I'm autistic. And it's everybody's personal preference, and I'm not going to tell anybody how to refer to themselves. But B, I think the change comes because for a long time, parents of autistic people wanted to make sure that their children weren't defined by their disability, or they were afraid that if they were called autistic, that it would lead to stigma. I think a younger generation, even though this young man, I think, is younger than I am, he's 24 and I'm 30 years old. A lot of younger autistic people, and I guess people who have understood themselves more, see that autism is inextricable from who they are. That it, a lot of people say, see the person, not the disability, or don't let your disability define you. No, like, I really need you to see my disability, and I need you to see other autistic people's disability, and I need you to see that A, that doesn't make them less, but B, that it is an intrinsic part to who they are. So I think that there's a divide, but again, I think that it really depends on how that person sees themselves. And again, I wouldn't tell this young man how to, I'm feeling old now, but I wouldn't tell this young man how to see himself. But I would, but more than anything, I'm curious why he sees that as important. To, why that distinction is important, because it's a distinction we all take and we all carry with each other. So,
thanks a lot for the call and the question, Kathy, at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Eric Michael Garcia. His new book is "We're Not Broken: Changing the Autism Conversation." Let's go back to your calls now. Michelle is with us in Kenosha. Michelle, hi.
Hi, Michelle.
Hi. Love this conversation. I have an uncle who was born in 1935 and wasn't diagnosed with autism till about 10 years ago.
Okay.
So, one, what I find interesting is, you know, that's just who he was. So our family had to deal with that. But he did have a successful life as a cabinet refinisher. He's extremely good with wood. But one thing I picked up on that you were talking about is how to deal with, how to address needs as people get older, because now that he's in his 80s, it's been a challenge because he feels pain differently. And so my cousins and I have to work with the medical professionals so that they understand, like, if he starts doing this grunting or screaming, he's in pain, but he doesn't know how to communicate that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it has been important for us to be translators for him. And it's interesting because, you know, on his own, it's like nobody listens. But if we help translate, then all of a sudden the doctor's like, oh, that's right. And then he gets treated and it solves the problem.
Michelle, thanks for that call. Eric, go for it.
That is really good. First off, that reminds me a lot of this woman and her mother I profiled in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, by the name of Lil Wayman, and her mother, Brookie. That, like, a lot of people didn't take Lydia seriously, but they took her mom seriously, so that when they go to the hospital, like, her mom goes with her. And that was really important because, like, she recognized that, like, and in some ways she could be an advocate for her. And then now Lydia can speak. So, you know, it's not, you know, she's not taken as unseriously as other people, even though there, I have some stories about, like, how people didn't think that she thought she was faking. But, like, that's really good that you recognize that him grunting or his screaming or things like that are him trying to communicate something. Because I think a lot of times when we focus on is that when people see that see autistic people screaming or see them, you know, grunting or even hurting themselves, a lot of times we focus on the behavior, but we don't focus on what actually is causing it. So A, that's really good. But B, you know, to my point, that's really why I wanted to write this book, because we really don't know a lot of things. I can't really, as much as I would like to give you a good answer, I don't think I could give you a good one, because we haven't, again, we only spend about 2%. In 2016, we only spent about 2% of all of our entire research budget looking at lifespan issues. And that's really tragic, because autism, and I think about it too, because eventually I'm going to get old. I'm going to be like, you know, your uncle. And I don't know what's going to happen. And that's a really tough question. I don't really know. I wish I had a better answer, but I don't. I'm sorry.
Thanks for that call. And Eric, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Eric Michael Garcia. He's a senior DC correspondent for The Independent, longtime political correspondent. He joined us for a look at his book today. It's called We're Not Broken: Changing the Autism Conversation. If you have a story to share with us, there's still time. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or you can always tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Coming up after the news, TV game shows like Jeopardy and The Price is Right are being honored as an important piece of American entertainment history in a new archive. We'll learn more and ask you to share your favorite game shows of all time. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.